step right up. The show's about to begin. Forget your troubles and raise your cups. Here's to this moment, it will never happen again.
This is Offstage and On the Air, performance number 513. I am Lisa Sheps, and I am joined by Nicole Shiro.
Hello!
Hello! You're listening to us on KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. This show, along with many others, streams live at KOOP.org. Remember, if it's theater, it's on Offstage and On the Air. Please stay with us.
Hurry, hurry, step right up. The show's about to begin. Troubles and raise your cup. Step right up, feast your eyes on the wonders of this world. Oh yeah.
Well, it's like he said, I'm an outdoor girl.
It is Wednesday, April 24th, 2019. On the show today, we have Theater and Block and their show, Severe Weather Warning by Elizabeth Doss. And John Reedy is going to be with us to talk about Austin Creative Alliance. And as promised, we will have the Bulb Story Slam winner from 2 weeks ago. Her name is Susan. I don't know her last name. She'll also share her story that we recorded. And of course, we'll have lively discussions of the world of theater in Austin, New York, Chicago, Boston, and New York again. Stick with us.
Why would he trade the sunshine?
Tell him how it is, brother.
Dibbity dibbity dot.
Living it up.
Living it up on top. That's a little bit of Hadestown.
So I know.
A little bit of Hadestown. We're going to talk about Hadestown in just a little second.
There's so much to talk about.
There
when
is
it comes
so much to talk
to
about.
Show.
Yep. So it's just you and me. Rebecca Melanson is gone.
Just
the two of us.
Yeah.
Let it whisper in your head. Just the two of us. Those were the original lyrics.
Yeah, Rebecca Melanson,
Au revoir, mon ami. Mon amour.
Makes me sad. Mon Dieu.
J'étais zélée au menton. That was totally made up language.
And well, I miss her, but I enjoyed having Rebecca here.
I know. It seems very lonely here in the studio. Well, checking in with you, Nicole Shiro.
I'm here.
Okay.
I am living it up on top.
There you go. Well, let's introduce...
How about you? How are you?
Living the dream.
There you go.
Living the dream. We had just an amazing show at the theater over the weekend. It's part of Fusebox Festival. I would encourage people.
I love Fusebox.
Yeah, Fusebox was amazing this year at Ground Floor Theater. I would encourage folks to look up Michelle Ellsworth and her art. She was here. She was with us in 2015. She was back again in 2016. Her show was impossible to describe, but just amazing. Amazing, amazing.
Isn't that so cool when you still think about art so far later on and you're like, I still can't even put it into words, but it moves you so much. Like, those are special moments.
Yeah, they are. And I totally respect her as an artist and her team. They did a great job.
Well, so, I'm giving her a radio jazz hand.
I'm sort of living that high, although I'm exhausted.
You're exhausted?
They say in Brooklyn.
No.
I'm exhausted.
I still think about some shows I saw at Fusebox.
Right in the microphone there, John Reedy.
I still think about some shows I saw at Fusebox 10 years ago.
Yeah. They do some amazing work.
Ron brings some great stuff into town.
That's Ron Barry of the Fusebox Festival. Let me take a moment to introduce the disembodied voices that you've just been listening to. That was John Reedy of Austin Creative Alliance. Hi, John.
Hi.
We have Giselle Munoz. Hello, Giselle.
Hello out there.
We have Elizabeth Doss and
Hello.
Broadwin.
Hello.
That was the little, now she's not going to say anything.
I was like, now she's quiet.
And then, of course, we have Jenny Lavery. Hi, Jenny.
Hi.
Lovely. We're going to get right to it. We're going to blast through a lot of these things because we really got a lot of stuff to do.
Let's do it. There's a lot.
And we're not going to get into a lot of details.
That's
because
fine.
We had 5 Broadway openings this week.
We sure did.
We have 2 more over the next 2 days.
We sure do.
Why are there so many Broadway openings right now, Nicole?
Well, there's a lot of articles about that right now, Lisa Sheps.
Well, name what? Like, what is the article saying?
Why are there so many Broadway openings right now? That's
well,
what all the articles have been saying.
It could be mentioning that the Tony Award deadline is the end of the weekend.
Cut off for nominations.
It's Sunday. So we had 5 that opened since we aired last, and we have 2 that are opening. Tonight is Ink, and tomorrow night is Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice.
Yes. My friend went last night to Beetlejuice.
And?
She actually enjoyed it. We had a whole conversation over the weekend. She decided she'd take her kids. So I was like, oh, great choice. But for the, you know, for kiddos, yeah, the Peanuts, I was like, but Amanda, she's my theater buddy for
years.
Did you
say the Peanuts? Oh, the Peanuts. I get it.
Yeah, her Peanuts, her kids. And she said it was a perfect choice. I was like, this song is painful, this song. And she goes, Nicole, it was a lot better than I went in. She goes, I actually really enjoyed it. She goes, yes, it was not a Color Purple moment.
My 10-year-old saw it this weekend.
Yeah,
he loved it.
That's what her kids really enjoyed it.
Gang, I hate to put a muzzle on this, but we will talk about this next week.
Well, you asked. That's what I told you.
No, I did not ask.
You did.
You just offered. But let's talk about the first opened last Wednesday night. A week ago tonight was Hadestown.
Yes.
With friend of the show, Patrick Page, is in it, who plays the devil. And this is
With that delightful deep voice of his.
It is a delightful. Well, Jesse Green called it a sumptuous, hypnotic, and somewhat hyperactive musical.
Well, you know what? I could have probably said that and I haven't even seen it yet because I just feel that way when I listen to it.
So this is written by Anais Mitchell and it is directed by Rachel Chafkin.
Chafkin.
Who also directed The Great Comet. They've been involved with this since it started off Broadway. It was in London. It was in D.C., I think, till it finally made it here to Broadway with team intact for the most part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, pretty much.
Which
almost.
That's not typical.
No, and there's been some really, really great press around this show, and not just on the actors, but on the creatives and on these women. And it's been really exciting. And they're young, young.
They're my classmates from NYU.
Oh, they are?
I was about to say, did you go to
Rachel and a lot of the design team?
Oh, amazing. Nice. Awesome. Well, great cast other than Patrick Page. We have Reeve Carney, Andre DeShields. And as we were talking last week, my mistake, Eva Noblezada.
Yes.
Who was the one I was thinking of when we talked?
When we were talking about Eva, Miss Saigon.
Right.
But yes.
Yeah.
But yes, that's a great reference.
And now I'm right. And we're talking about that now, but nobody's heard it yet because we have not aired that.
No, but that'll come on later.
It'll come next week.
It's a teaser.
So everybody is saying this is a shoo-in for best musical, but the reviews do not bear that out. The reviews are mixed to the side of being good, but they're not. It's not. They weren't raves.
I don't know. Listen to the album. It's the first cast album from Broadway that I've downloaded front to end in a long time. Mm-hmm. And did you see that they just announced they're re-recording another cast album?
Why?
That will have the Reeve Carney in it now and this cast because he's not in it.
So this is the telling of Orpheus and I cannot pronounce Eurydice.
Eurydice.
I was sitting there reading this. I said, I need to look this up because I know I'm not pronouncing it correctly. Eurydice. And I never did. So the New York Post said it's still too slick and sterile. So this says, this classic tale of love is still too slick and sterile for us to give a damn about her damnation. The set is concentric circle turntables, which seems to be the thing to do these days.
Mm-hmm.
This is like, other than Hamilton, there was another one we were talking about. We couldn't remember what it was, but this one is basically the same thing. So everybody's doing that.
It's kind of been like that almost since the beginning. They haven't really changed a lot of that.
I don't care. It's still the thing to do.
Well, I guess.
Anyway, so that's Hadestown. So we will find out whether it's
going to be on the top of my list.
Music is great.
Oh, so good.
Music is great. And
I love me some Patrick and Reeve, though.
Story
too,
sounds
so.
Like fun. The other thing that opened was Hillary and Clinton.
Yes. With the John Lithgow play. And
with the John Lithgow. Did you
Gordon
see it?
Metcalf.
I haven't seen it. I've read it.
Okay. And?
I think it's great.
It's great. Well, it tells the story of Hillary and Clinton. It actually tells the story of Hillary and Clinton at the time in 2008 during her first run for president when she lost the primary to Barack Obama. And it's got four characters in it. Hillary is played by the incomparable
Laurie Metcalf.
And then John Lithgow plays Clinton. And that's Bill Clinton. There's also a Barack Obama character played by Zach Orth, I think. And then And then one other character. I can't remember that.
I forgot.
Character's name. But it is Peter Francis James plays it. Also, good review, not great reviews. And it really tells the story of a marriage more than the political story that, mm-hmm. that comes around. So I found that interesting. It says, the show is asking us to see the world through the eyes of a woman who ostensibly has all the right stuff to be president, is yet never allowed to win. So it's sort of zeroing in on Hillary here. And in terms of the reviews, they all love Metcalf and like John Lithgow a lot.
I don't know how you dislike those two.
That's true.
I mean, you just have to be... I don't even know. I guess we couldn't be friends. I don't know how you dislike those two.
That's true. So play is written by Lucas Nath. God, dog it. He also wrote Doll's House Part 2.
Tomato, tomato, Lisa.
Exactly.
Potato, potato.
And and Laurie Metcalf also played Nora in Doll's House Part 2. And one of the things to say is that her portrayal of Hillary is very similar to her portrayal of Nora. So much to say is in the review. Let me see who did it. I think it was Brantley. But we're about to find out. It was indeed. He says, it is not a criticism to say that Miss Metcalf's Hillary looks and sounds a lot like her Nora, even if in this case she's wearing sweatpants and fleeces instead of a corset and floor-swept skirts. Miss Metcalf becomes the other people not by putting on disguises. So I think it's sort of an interesting way that they're characterizing Laurie Metcalf's style of acting in a good way. Charles Isherwood said, but Nath, one of the most talented and adventurous theater writers to emerge in the last decade, finds few fresh insights about either the semi-fictional Clintons' complicated marriage and careers or the problems of American politics. Greg Evans of Deadline says, the cast couldn't be better. There are no impersonations here, with Metcalf and Lithgow hitting some of the deeper and more satisfying, gaining universality while nailing the specific. This is directed by Joe Montello. And Robert Hofner said he's
Montello, Montello.
Stop making fun of the way I speak. The rap for Robert Hofner says he's a minimalist director who fills the stage with playwrights' words and actors' performances. That's an especially spectacular achievement here. I think it's good. And then finally, Sarah Holden of Vulture says Hillary and Clinton isn't really a political play. Like A Doll's House Part 2, it's a marriage play inside an attention-getting box. Would you say that's an accurate...
I think one of the things that's interesting about the play, and it's been a minute since I read it, so mm-hmm. I may be wrong, but the playwright says that you should steer away from impersonations and uh-huh. also that casting right. should be as diverse as possible and not... So it's interesting because this production sounds a little bit like yeah. it's close to the characters or to the real people.
It does.
And so I'm interested if something's missing from the story based on casting.
Right.
Well, it's interesting because if you look at any interviews with Lori or John, mm-hmm. they talk about her saying that and that they steer away from being and impersonating Bill and Hillary, which I just it's
But if you look at the production photos, it doesn't seem that way.
Yeah, I'm curious.
No, I'm just saying that's why I find this all like
yeah.
interesting.
If there'd be more nuance by casting some people in those roles that are very different from
right.
the real Clintons.
Right. Interesting.
Audra McDonald.
Curiouser, said Alice to the Catapult. Listen, she can't because she's gonna go in the Frankie and the Johnny, so stop. We need her in that.
I don't know what that means, but I'll just say yes.
Frankie and Johnny at Claire de Lune. She's doing the revival, the Terrence McNally.
Didn't know that. You are Terrence McNally crazed
because
these days.
Because I have always been Terrence McNally crazed my whole life. The guy is a genius.
We have 1 minute to cover 3 more Broadway shows.
And there's some I still want to talk about.
So we're going to blast through. The next one to open was Gary, a sequel to Titus Andronicus by Taylor Mack.
Yep. With some delayed openings it had.
It had a delayed opening because of some casting issues. But mm-hmm.
But then it delayed again after that.
Right. But it opened. And the reviews were mixed as well.
Yep.
Not as great as you would have liked to, but it stars the incomparable
Nathan Lane
as Gary. So this takes off at the end of Titus Andronicus with all the dead bodies in this makeshift morgue, and there is a nurse and a fool. Yeah, he's a fool at this point. Gary, that are set to clean up the bodies. And one of the things I liked about it, this is written by Jason Green. They say that this show is the unlikeliest bird to land on Broadway in many a year.
Okay, have we looked at the author? Because, I mean, it's just so him.
So...
or they,
so
sorry.
So speaking... well, not they, actually, Judy. And that's one of the things I want to talk about. Many of the reviews used Mr. and he and him to refer to Taylor Mack. Taylor Mack does not use male or female gendered. He doesn't use they or them. He uses Judy.
Judy.
Oh, and I just said he. Damn it.
Judy uses Judy.
So I find it interesting that many of these critics in print used he, him, and Mr. And I'm a little... angry about it, and Jesse Green was one of them.
But they also did it in that big piece with Nathan Lane last weekend where they had that picture of him sitting on set with the dead bodies and did an interview. They did it again there, too.
So I think that's a little disrespectful.
Regardless
of the fact that Taylor Mack opts to use Judy, that is Judy's prerogative to choose that, and people should respect that. That's all I'm saying. Show I'd still like to see. And very quickly, All My Sons was a mixed bag of reviews. A lot of the reviews were very positive. The Times didn't like it.
And they were very different.
And they were very different. This stars Tracy Letts, Annette Bening, amongst other people, which I just love. But
I do love her, too.
Then the other thing to open last night was Tootsie.
Yes!
Which got great reviews.
Yeah!
And Santino Font, I know. And it's a little fraught. Well, it's kind of, it's one of the people that I listen to podcasts thinks it's very biased against women in it. But just generally speaking, but the play looks good. So instead of a movie or instead of a soap opera, it's a Broadway play. And the Broadway play inside the Broadway play is called Juliet's Curse. It's Romeo and Juliet, where she is resurrected, and she falls in love with Romeo's brother, Craig. So
Nick went to the Chicago opening, and he loved it. I had a few friends that went this week, and they were totally like, I did not think I was going to go out of there loving it like I did.
People like it.
I text Lisa, I go, it's slowly creeping up my list. Yep. Who knew?
Who are the writers on it? Do you know?
Yes, I do know.
Rather
than just guess, I'm going to read it. How does that sound? It's David Yazbek did the music and lyrics, and the book is by Robert Horn. Directed by Scott Ellis. So, good pedigrees. I'm afraid that's all we can really talk about. There's so much more I wanted to talk about. Specifically, I wanted to talk about this show, concept album show, Struck with Alan Cumming. Do you hear about this?
Yes, it opened... yes.
I don't like the music. The score... Cast album is already out.
Mm-hmm.
It's available on iTunes, and there is just way too much effect on it. I was going to play it, but I didn't like it, so I'm not.
Well, that new one with John Cameron Mitchell is coming out too, so we'll have to listen to that in a week.
Yeah, so we're going to take a little break. I should say this, that you know, the Jimmys, which is the national version of the Greater Austin High School Musical Theater Awards, just released their
peeps.
They're like
peeps.
Easter peeps?
No.
They're the school teacher of the year. The school teacher, you want to get the right, the Inspiring Teacher Award. And I just wanted to mention them. It's Matthew Henson of Charlotte, North Carolina, and Tasha Partee of Woodmere, New York. They are the honorees. So we like to talk about theater education.
Yep.
And I just wanted to say their name on the air.
They're peeps. They're teacher peeps.
All right. So here we're going to go out listening to a little bit of Follies. This is a brand new recording of the London cast. The recording just came out. This is Buddy's Blues, because I like that song.
I love this song.
I like that
song.
But
the whole end of Follies is great.
There you go. I've never seen it. Want to.
Oh, I've been in it.
We'll be back.
I got those. God, why don't you love me? Oh, you do. I'll see you later.
We are back. You're listening to Offstage and on the Air with Lisa Sheps and Nicole Shiro.
Shiro and Shep, Sheps and Shiro. Yeah.
We are on the FM dial at 91.7 FM, KOOP.org, streaming all the time.
That's right.
All the time we're streaming.
You can listen to us live.
So we've had some wonderful conversations, and we're going to narrow our focus now and talk to Theater on Block and their show, Severe Weather Warning, by Elizabeth Doss, who is right here in the studio with us. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi.
We also have Jenny Lavery, the director and the artistic director of Theater on Block.
Hi.
Was that not the right title?
No.
You gave me the stink eye just
then. I did?
Then. You did.
I was deep in thought, sorry.
And Giselle Munoz,
I don't know what I was thinking about.
Who is one of the performers.
Hello.
And an incredible person in her own right.
She is.
So what an appropriate day to be talking about Severe Weather Warning.
Right?
Yeah, we timed it this way, actually.
Excellent. So, Elizabeth, tell us about this show.
Well, the play is about four women who desperately need a weekend getaway. And,
am I in it?
Yeah, you're in it.
Because it sounds like it.
And so they take this vacation, and it doesn't go exactly as planned. And sort of the night and their histories all get a little out of hand, as does the weather outside.
Of course. And so this is a comedy.
It's a comma-tragedy.
A comma-tragedy.
Yeah.
A tragic, oh, well, we've heard tragic comedy. I like comma-tragedy.
I like comma-tragedy, yeah.
Well, I think in terms of the sequential order of the play, it starts out comedy and then moves maybe a little bit further away from that. Sort of like a storm. It starts out lighter. You know, just a few clouds, just a little sprinkle.
In many ways, that's kind of a calling card for Theater on Block's work. It always has a message. It's always pretty hard-hitting. And oftentimes, you're not expecting it when it hits you.
Yeah. I mean, that's the theater that I'm attracted to.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, that seems on brand.
There you go. Well, thanks for being on the show.
Oh, that was pretty funny.
So how long ago did y'all start working on this?
Before I had a baby. So it's been at least a couple years.
We should say to the radio audience that Broadwin, who we introduced earlier, is a little 6-month-old human being.
She was 7 months yesterday.
Yeah. And she's here with us in the studio.
She is. She's getting in a little snooze.
She's totally passed out sideways and just totally adorable now.
It's very sweet. So, and I think this the play kind of does a good job of, or the intention is to sort of straddle this moment in many women's lives in their mid to late 30s, where some people have decided to have children, some people haven't, and somehow those decisions are starting to feel finite and shaping the sort of trajectory of your own life. So we started this play before I was pregnant, and in the process of the play, I got pregnant and had a baby. So I feel like there's four women, two are moms, two are not, and I feel like I've lived both of their lives now.
I was like, have you lived the life of your character? That's interesting.
Yeah.
And the characters in the play, two are moms and two are not.
Two are moms, two are not, and that creates alliances and divisions between these characters.
Yeah.
I think
which is very real life in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
Is it?
It is,
because I have to be honest with you, as someone who isn't married, doesn't have children, and in my late 40s, I am still friends with all my friends who got married and have children. It never created a difference with me.
I don't think it's about friendship. I think it's about, and it's the same thing whenever, for instance, I don't have any kids either, but when my brother and sister, they had dogs and it was all about their dogs. And then they had kids and all of a sudden it was all about their kids. And the dog people went away.
Yeah.
So it has to do with
priorities
and what becomes relatable at a given time. And that changes in our lives.
Mm-hmm. And I think
friendships are still there. I mean, I'm the same way.
Yeah, but I guess I get just excited about my friends' children and their accomplishments as if they were my own, I guess. I don't know.
Okay.
You've seen them grown up.
Yeah.
Grow up, correct?
Yeah.
You've been part of their lives.
So Giselle, tell us about the character you're playing.
So I play Anne. She is a mother of four, and she works very hard at keeping her house in line, making sure that her kids have activities. And she is desperately in need of having a girl's weekend away. So she's done all the shopping, she's done all of the party favors, and she has to make sure that everybody is having fun And she does her best, and we will see how she does.
Where does it take place? Are we in, like, my mind is taking me to the Keys, but I'm guessing it's not the Keys.
We're in Texas, the Rockport Coast.
Oh, Rockport.
Rockport. Okay. And what's keeping interesting local, is baby. It's about a potential hurricane. I started the play.
Well, because Rockport
before,
got hit.
Yeah, but I started the play before Rockport okay. got hit.
Oh, wow.
And that was a really strange...
your fault.
I do sometimes carry a lot of guilt.
I think you should. My brother lost his house. I'm going to give him your number.
Yeah.
So did my aunt. So we'll stick our family on you.
And looking at the aftermath of Rockport as we were working on the end of the play, I think was sad and necessary dramaturgy.
Sure. That makes sense. Yeah. Well,
that's so wild.
Yeah.
So this is a world premiere.
It is a world premiere. We're lucky to have Scriptworks Finer Points funding on it for this world premiere.
Congratulations that on really that. Scriptworks awesome. Is a great organization that supports playwrights here in the Austin area, which is amazing. Hi, Christy. Shout out to Christy.
Christy!
It's amazing. There's hundreds of people in the organization, and you wouldn't think that...
And the work is so good. So good.
Yeah. Yeah,
and so with this production, we're also trying to make the Long Center feel more accessible. And so part of that is we're featuring visual artists in the lobby, mainly women of color. So that all of that artwork will be hung, and then before every show, starting at 7:15, we're featuring singer songwriters.
Oh, great. And is anybody invited to that piece of it?
Yeah.
Ticket holders or no?
Yeah, totally.
Okay.
So awesome. you don't need a ticket for the show. You can come at 7:15 and that goes
that's
on
a
until
wonderful
about
7:15.
Yeah, that's really awesome.
Yeah.
So you've just said you're at the Long Center at the Rollins. When do you open?
We open tomorrow.
You open tomorrow.
Dun, 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 dun.
The day of the show, y'all.
And how long do you
play? I'm
going
to give you Radio Jazz hands.
It's only 2 weeks.
So it's May 5th.
A very short run through May 5th.
And where
nine performances, though.
Okay, awesome. And I know you had a Wednesday performance in there, which is really good for those of us in the industry. Usually Wednesday night shows are called Industry Night. Mm-hmm. And because you've done it, Ground Floor Theater has started to instigate that as well. So we just follow everything you do. Where can folks go to get more information?
TheLongCenter.org.
LongCenter.org or TheaterOnBlock.com.
Yes.
We'll also take you there. You know what? Because I double checked it, and the website says .com.
Both actually work.
Okay.
We own both.
Awesome. great. Well, thank you guys for being on the show.
Thank you so much.
That was Jenny Lavery, Giselle Marie Munoz, and Elizabeth Marie Munoz, and Elizabeth Doss, and Broadwin.
Yay, Broadwin.
All of Theater and Block's production of Severe Weather Warning by Elizabeth Doss. Opens April 25th, plays through May 5th at the Long Center Rollins Stage. For more information, theateronblock.org. And we will be right back. This is from Amelie.
World's best.
We are back. I just tried to talk to us without the microphone on. That Severe Weather Warning sounds awesome.
I love it. And I have to say, I didn't give them a shout out. I love their artwork on this. It's so vibrant and exciting. So I know they're listening to the other side.
Yeah, they're here.
They're still here.
I
love... Look at how cool and vibrant that is, Lisa.
It is vibrant.
Yeah, it makes me excited.
Yeah. So congratulations, Jenny.
You know a little friendship never killed anyone.
Mackenzie Graham.
I like this a lot.
It's a
awesome.
Party.
We're going to go straight to Today at Theater History.
Today in Theater History.
But before we do that, hold on, there was something. I just have to mention that at Ground Floor Theater is a very interesting thing this weekend. Church of the Friendly Ghost, which always does amazing work, is doing their show Grinto, which is a music experience. There's only 35 people in the house. You sit on pillows and you look up at there's projections up in the ceiling.
Okay,
it looks
that sounds
interesting.
So cool.
Yeah.
Is there more information on?
More information on groundfloortheater.org. We'll get you there.
Grinto.
And it actually means something. And
it sounds like it means something.
Yeah, you
I'll
can
have
Google
to
it.
Look it up and figure it out.
So let's talk about Today in Theater History.
Today in Theater History.
Today in Theater History.
Today. History.
John Reedy knows all about theater history. But in 1977, Al Pacino opened in The Basic Training of Pablo Hamill. by David Rabe, and I was in the audience.
Were you?
I was. I did not like it.
I was about to say, was this the one where you were like, I did not like, I think we've had an Al Pacino
I did not like Al Pacino in this.
Yes, I remember this.
He was very affected, didn't like him.
Yes, I remember this conversation. Sorry,
but,
Al.
But he did really well.
I was like, did it affect his career?
No. And in 1997, a duo named John Kander and Fred Ebb, they have a show called Steel Pier. It opened on Broadway at the Richard Rogers Theater with Karen Zambia, Gregory Harrison, Daniel McDonald, and Deborah Monk, along with Kristen Chenoweth.
Yeah, and I actually believe Scott Ellis, who we were talking about earlier, was in the cast at that point.
Maybe.
He was one of their proteges in like all their shows back then.
Yep. It only played 68 performances, didn't do quite well. It was at the Marquee Theater.
No. Which you remember Gregory Harrison, right? Trapper John, MD?
Yeah, of course. Who doesn't? In 2012, another composer duo that might get somewhere, George Gershwin and Ira Gershwin.
They may need to work a little harder.
They did their new show, the brand new show, if you remember correctly.
Brand new show.
Nice Work If You Can Get It, which starred one Matthew Broderick.
I was like, and Mr. Broderick.
And Kelly O'Hara.
Yeah.
And it got mixed reviews, but it played for a while.
I wouldn't say it. I don't remember it being like overly crazy, and it played it. Eh, I didn't go.
Yeah, I'm with you. And in 2013, John Logan's show, I'll Eat You Last, A Chat with Sue Mengers. Do you remember this?
Oh, yes.
Do you remember who starred in it?
Oh, my goodness.
The incomparable Miss Bette.
Was it?
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't get to see that.
I didn't either. And then 2016, Waitress opened. That by my new favorite, Sarah Bareilles. And I really would like Sarah Bareilles and Josh Groban to host again.
You know why? Because like the Grobes is everything,
it's because
Lisa,
the pair of them.
I
know, but I think you're wrong.
It was
directed by Diane Paulus, and it starred Jesse Mueller, and it got a million awards.
Did you see they extended the
latest group.
Yep.
And then 2017, your friend Terrence McNally wrote the book for a show called Anastasia.
Yes.
Which I can, no offense to Terrence McNally, can live without this show.
No offense, it's not my favorite either. It's okay. But what great book he wrote? And it was a Kander and Ebb musical?
Yes.
The Rink.
That's right.
1984.
So today's birthday, Barbara Streisand and Eric Bogosian.
I called Babs this morning.
Yeah, me too.
She was down in her basement mall.
And Shirley MacLaine.
Oh, Shirley. That's a good one.
Shirley MacLaine. Okay, so let's... John Reedy, could you choose a number between 2 and 837?
758.
Let's see what that is.
Hello, I'm Ben Vereen, and you're listening to Offstage and On the Air on KOOP Hornsby, Austin.
Ben Vereen, good job, John Reedy.
We haven't heard that one in a long time.
We haven't. We usually, when we do, we hear it, the musical version.
The musical version of them.
Yep. So we're going to take a break, and we're going to come back and hear more about John Reedy and what he is up to.
That's John Reedy, and what is he up to?
Bum, 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 bum.
John Reedy, he's going to tell us.
Dun, 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 dun. Okay, we're going to listen to a little bit of Kristen Chenoweth and Steel Pier on the way.
Oh, lovely.
We'll be back.
I can hear that merry-go-round.
We are back. You're listening to Offstage and On the Air with Lisa Sheps and Nicole Shiro.
Hello, it's Nicole Shiro.
And I'm John Reedy.
Lisa Sheps.
Hi.
And we are here at KOOP. I may as well say the whole thing. HD1, HD3, Hornsby.
That's right.
That's the legal way we do it.
Yeah, that's right.
And we are streaming live at KOOP.org. And we are
four kooky gals just hanging out this Wednesday afternoon.
We are kooky. Yeah. You know, those of you listening on the podcast that are listening is from as far away as Alaska and Japan.
Yes. Konnichiwa.
You can always, if you want to catch us live, you can go to KOOP.org. At 1 o'clock Central Time on Wednesdays and catch us live.
Yes, and you can just Google the time conversion if you're out of our time zone.
Yeah, or any kind of search engine thing. Doesn't have to be Google.
Yeah,
Yeah, but
I think
my
it's a
computer
verb now actually.
My computer came with the Google, right?
No, but
on
I think
it.
It's actually now a verb in the dictionary. Isn't that funny?
But anyway, we're here to talk to John Reedy, who is the CEO of Austin Creative Alliance.
That's the CEO. Which,
The CEO. Of Austin Creative Alliance. What is this organization, Austin Creative
Who
Alliance?
Who are you, John Reedy? What do you do?
Austin Creative Alliance is Central Texas' largest art services organization. We serve all disciplines, both nonprofit and commercial.
Right.
And we really try to just empower creatives to build careers and build organizations in the community.
Right, so you're working with, one of the things that you do is sponsor organizations that want to apply for city funding, do you
That's
not?
That's right. Yeah, it's called fiscal sponsorship. We have about 108 organizations in that bucket.
Yeah, so that's
a good amount.
For nonprofits that, for whatever reason, either they don't want to or they think that it's too daunting, they don't want to get their own 501c3, they can go to your organization and you can help them be able to woo tax-deductible
donors. It's like an umbrella.
Yeah, they can get tax-deductible donations through us. They can apply for City of Austin cultural arts funding, other funding from foundations and other government entities. And, you know, some choose to stay fiscally sponsored under that umbrella because maybe they're doing it part-time. It's not a full-time thing. Others, we've graduated, including, like, Fusebox Festival was once a sponsored project.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And now off on their own.
Yep. We love grad. Just recently, last year, the Asian American, Austin Asian American Film Festival graduated out into its own C3. That's a big part of it. We want to help them grow to where they can stand on their own.
Yeah. That's cool.
Well, the big scary secret is it's no longer as difficult as it used to be to obtain a 501c3 status.
It's not.
From the IRS. It used to be, and I've done it several times myself, it used to be really daunting.
Yeah.
So not only was an organization like Austin Creative Alliance a good thing, but in many cases it was a necessary thing.
Necessary.
Mm-hmm. So you also advocate for arts across the board, correct?
Yes.
What are some of the disciplines that you deal with?
Well, our roots are in theater.
Mm-hmm. You were the Austin Circle of Theaters.
That's right, mm-hmm. until about 2010.
Something like that.
Yeah, and that dates back to the 70s. But we've made, you know, real efforts to get involved with the visual art scene, the film scene, the nonprofit music, especially classical and chamber music scenes, and try to build that community so we can connect people. And in fact, my favorite part of the job is when an artist comes to us and has a vision but doesn't know a composer or doesn't know a set designer or doesn't know somebody or, you know. So I love getting those cross-disciplinary things going.
Yeah. And one of the other things that the Austin Creative Alliance does, if I'm not mistaken, is advocacy.
That's right.
What type of things do you advocate for and to whom?
You know, the big thing in the last 4 years has been approaching this situation that I think we all know about, which is the lack and loss of affordable space in the city for all disciplines. And what it really is, it's a symptom of just these property values going increasing faster than many businesses, both for and nonprofit, can keep up. So we've lost literally hundreds of thousands of square feet of performance and studio space in just the last 3 years.
Now, it is a typical thing to happen across the country that the creative class will go into an undesirable neighborhood because that's all they can afford.
Mm-hmm.
They create creative spaces in those neighborhoods, which then brings in other people that follow, and those same neighborhoods then become very valuable.
Right.
And many times that creative class that started is driven out along with the longtime residents of that. But that happens everywhere, not just in Austin. Is Austin unique in some way?
Austin is unique in some way that in that our nonprofit arts sector has one of the lowest rates of ownership of spaces in the country.
Uh-huh.
And we want to break that cycle. The advocacy work we're doing is to create policies that will lead to ownership so that we're not having organizations pushed out and to a new part of town and then 5 years later out again and 5 years
right,
later out
which
again.
Which is exactly happened in the theater world. Mm-hmm. Last year, or 2 years ago, I guess now, Salvage Vanguard and the Rude Mix were both displaced from their home because their landlords either wanted to do something else with the space or the rents got so high that they couldn't.
Yeah, we've seen organizations facing 400% rents when their leases are up. And 3 years ago, we surveyed 230 groups and over 50% of them did not expect to be able to renew their current space. So what we're seeing is a slow motion, and it's picking up steam, cascade of losses. Pump Project lost their space. Tapestry Dance lost their space. It's across disciplines.
Yeah, it's really, as someone that's been in embroiled in all that myself personally, it's really fraught and very difficult. In the world of difference from my own personal experience, having owned my first building for my first theater and renting my current theater, mm-hmm. it's a 180-degree difference in terms of ownership, if you will.
I mean,
you
really ownership.
You really feel like you're in much more control when you own your own space.
Yeah, ownership allows you to focus on the work. You know, one of the things that we talk about with our members a lot is just the sheer amount of time they spend looking for space, how that cuts into their practice,
sure.
to their service to the community, and also it affects jobs. We're talking about fewer available jobs for artists in town because especially arts education organizations and programs can't find space
right.
to hold classes, which would employ artists and serve the community.
Right. And, you know, arts education specifically is difficult in that we don't get a lot of support from our state government,
mm-hmm.
Not only financial support, but emotional support from our government. We don't feel like that they see the value in arts education.
I mean, and you can't talk enough about arts education. We know that kids who have arts education have better outcomes, whether they pursue an artistic practice or not. And we also know that it employs artists I work with, puts their income together from a variety of sources, and arts education is a key part of that. And it enhances the community up and down the spectrum of socio and political and economic.
Cool. You know. In our last minute, John, is there anything that the ACA... Well, first of all, how long have you been CEO?
I'm coming up on 5 years.
5 years. Is there anything that a two-part question.
Uh-huh.
What are you most proud of in your past 5 years, and what are you looking forward to accomplishing in the next 5 years?
You know, I think that I'm really proud of how we've diversified both culturally and disciplines.
Easy for you to say.
Well, I mean, we're up to almost 47% of our membership is non-white or non-binary. And that was a concerted effort. It was only like 12% when I got there. And that
it's a
enhances.
Big jump.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah. And that enhances everything. You're talking about creating new dialogues and communication and cross-discipline and cultural stuff. And then I think our biggest sort of success in the advocacy space was that we worked with Councilmember Ann Kitchen to get that $12 million Creative Spaces Fund in the last bond election.
Right.
And now we're working with the Arts and Music Commissions and the city management and council to figure out how to allocate that money. We really want to use that $12 million to empower ownership for existing groups who have a proven record of community service.
Awesome. So if people wanted more information about the Austin Creative Alliance or wanted to become a member of the Alliance, or maybe they want to get their own fiscal sponsorship through the Alliance for their own nonprofit,
how
would they find you?
AustinCreativeAlliance.org.
Awesome. John Reedy, thank you for coming on the
show. Thank
you. Yeah, thank you for coming on.
Yes. We were just talking that I think we had Latifah on years ago, and that was the last time we had
the
ACA on.
I know.
And it might have been ACOT back then.
No,
Austin Circle Theaters.
You know what?
Who
it
knows?
May have been still.
Anyway, so that was John Reedy. He's the CEO of Austin Creative Alliance. For more information, AustinCreativeAlliance.org. We're back. You're listening to Offstage and On the Air with Lisa and Nicole.
Lisa and Nicole.
Nicole and Lisa.
Yes.
March 25th.
That's my mother's birthday.
It's your mother's birthday. Well, we had a Bulb Story Slam that was sponsored by Co-op Radio at the Ground Floor Theater. And part of that was we were going to play the at least some of those stories on the air. So I'm really proud right now to play the winner of that story slam.
Susan.
And you know what? I went by nowhere in our notes does it say her last name. So
you know
Susan,
why? She's as cool as Prince. It's just... Susan.
It's just the Sues.
Like Cher
the
and Sues. Prince. Susan.
Yeah. And the Sues. So let's listen to Susan and her story. It's actually really good. From the Bulb Story Slam on March 25th at Ground Floor Theater.
Hi, everyone. So, Halloween, 1998. I was living in Silicon Valley, Mountain View, about 45 minutes south of San Francisco. And I had a dilemma. My roommate and her friends had invited me to go with them to the Castro for Halloween if I could get a costume together. Now, the dilemma was not whether I thought I should leave the house to go to the Castro, because I don't know how many of you have heard about the street parties that used to happen in the Castro for Halloween, but they were not to be missed. No matter what your sexual orientation was, almost all of San Francisco, Silicon Valley, and people internationally flew in to hit this street party because they closed off about 8 blocks of the street, and it was a celebration of everything gay San Francisco. And I mean, you might see costumes as innocent as the California raisins, or you might see someone wearing combat boots, a cape, and nothing else, and everything in between. So I wanted to see the spectacle, but the dilemma was that I needed to get a costume together. And my roommate and her friends had been getting together for a few weeks, getting their costumes together, and they were gluing felt on to be life-sized boxes of candy. Like, my roommate who went to MIT was going to be a box of Nerds, and our friend Athena, who was very sexy with red hair, was Red Hots, and our cool friend Cynthia was Chiclets, and my roommate's boyfriend Edwin, who was this really tall Filipino guy, was Big Daddy, and I did not have a costume. Now, as a side note about me and Halloween costumes, I grew up in a homophobic, fundamentalist, misogynist cult that really took that verse in the Bible about thou shalt not have any other gods before me very seriously. And they believed that any religious holiday not listed in Leviticus was an affront to God. So therefore, there was no Halloween going on in my house. So when my school friends would like spend weeks making their Wonder Woman costumes or their robot costumes and then go around trick-or-treating, we would spend Halloween hiding in our house with all the lights off, hoping that no one would egg our house because we weren't giving out candy. Not that I was bitter or jealous. So I didn't have that history growing up of making my Halloween costumes. And when I went to college and decided I really want to go to Halloween parties, I felt that the appropriate level of effort was, let's find something in my closet that can pretend to be a costume. So I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to do. I've missed the felt candy making get-togethers, and I was kind of busy with work. But the weekend before Halloween, I went up to Seattle, and my best friend's 9-year-old daughter came up with the best solution for me to get rid of my dilemma so I could go. And she said, dress as a lollipop. You just have to wear, like, white and then put a round thing on your head. And I thought, man, even I can manage a lollipop costume. So the day of Halloween, I go to the House of Foam in Palo Alto, which was a store I'd always wanted an excuse to go to because, like, in ritzy Palo Alto, in the middle of, like, downtown University Street Palo Alto, there's, like, this House of Foam. And I went in and I thought, I can probably buy like a colored circle of foam or something like that. But no, it was an upholstery foam shop. And so all they had was like kind of flesh-colored foam. And I thought, that's not really a lollipop, but I'll spray paint it. So I buy this like 3-foot circle of foam that's flesh-colored. And I go to the hardware store, and I'm thinking, okay, what's going to work in the least amount of time? I can get red. I love the color red. I'm wearing the color red tonight. I'll spray paint it red. So I spray paint it, and it looks pretty good, and I go off and do something else. And then when it's time to leave, I notice, well, maybe, like, I didn't account for the fact that foam, like, really sucks in spray paint. So it's not, like, totally perfectly red, and there's areas where maybe it's, like, a little bit mottled and fresh colored. But I figured it's going to be dark. It's good enough. I'll look like a lollipop. And I also didn't cut, like, the hole for my face exactly to my face. It was a little bit small. So it kind of, like, when I put it on, it sort of curled around my face a little bit, maybe, like, even ripped a little bit. But I still figured I looked enough like a lollipop, it would be fine. So we drive, like, we pick up our friends. 5 of us drive 45 minutes north to San Francisco. And I put this on, and we're walking towards Castro Street from our car. And I start noticing that maybe people's reactions aren't exactly lollipop-like. But it doesn't hit me how far away from the mark I've gotten until we hit Castro Street. And there's this group of lesbian queen bees. They're all hovering around this drag queen bee. And there's like this big group of like 20 of them. And they see me and they all freeze in place. Like they stop moving. And one of them says, "Girlfriend, come here." And I walk over and I have these red lollipops. And I said, "Hi, I'm a lollipop. Want a lollipop?" And she says, "Oh, honey, I can think of a lot of better things you could be." At which point I realize that I do not look like a lollipop. I look like an 8-foot-tall, walking, talking vagina. And I did not plan this, so I was pretty embarrassed. But fortunately, in that moment, I make eye contact with Edwin's uncle Julio, who's this 50-something Filipino man, gay man, who lives in the Castro with this wonderful caretaker personality. And we lock eyes, and I realize that just as I'm realizing I look like a giant vagina, he's realizing I look like a giant vagina. And my face is turning red, and there are tears starting to come out of my eyes. And his face is red, and there are tears starting to come out of his eyes. But mine are from embarrassment, and his are because this is the funniest thing he's ever seen in his life. And so we just like held this extended moment of eye contact where my embarrassment blends with his humor and it feels really safe. And then finally I feel like, okay, it's safe to look away. And as I look away, thoughts start coming in like, oh, what am I going to do now? Like, can I just go back home? No, I've got 5 people with me. Should I just take my costume off? That feels like failure. And oh, thank God I didn't put that lick me sign on that I thought would help people know I was a lollipop. And as I'm pondering what to do, my friend Athena says, you know, you just have to go with it. And Edwin says, you need a G in the middle of your forehead. And Athena pulls out her lipstick. And the next thing I know, things get fun. All of a sudden, everyone is so happy to find me. And they'll, like, rub on my foam, and I'll go, woo-hoo-hoo-hoo. And Japanese tourists want their picture taken with me. And there's a group of guys dressed in white with swim caps and T-shirts that say Fallopian Swim Team who all come and just swarm around me and jump up and down with excitement. And this goes on for a couple of hours. And then it's hitting the end of the night, and there's this group of guys at the end of the street, and they're talking to my friends, and one of them says, wait a second, I don't get it. She's Chiclets, and she's Red Hots, and she's a box of nerds. What are you? And his friend says, she's a vagina. And the guy says, no, she's much too nice to be that. And I said, I'm a lollipop. Here, take a lollipop. And then I looked at my friends, and we decided, yeah, it's probably time to go home. And after I went home, my friend called to find out how the lollipop costume went, and her daughter was on speakerphone, and I just said, it was a big hit.
We are back. Or we never left. That
never
was Susan.
Left. We've just
congratulations
been laughing.
To Susan. We've been sitting and listening and laughing.
Every time I listen to that,
it gets
laughing.
Even better. Yeah. So that was Susan. I'm going to make an attempt to find out her last name.
She may just tell you it's Susan.
It could be, and post it on the website. But that's from the Bulb Story Slam. And I should say that we have a couple of programmers here at the radio station that are going to do a Bulb Story Slam half hour show, weekly show featuring stories from the Bulb Story Slam.
Who's doing that?
Well, Aaron Cornett is one, and I forgot the name of the other. Thank you for putting me on the spot.
I'm sorry.
So, but there are a couple of really great programmers here, so much so that my feeble mind can't remember names.
I lose stuff in my head. It'll come back to you now when we go off.
Anyway, I am one of them as well, so I'm going to be part of the group since it's happening at the theater.
When's that start?
Well, when they apply for it here at the station.
Nice!
And the station,
so we get to keep people posted on that.
Yes, they have to apply and they have to be accepted. So that's the next step. So anyway, that was Susan, last name to come from the Bulb Story Slam. It was a great show today. Yeah, she's away from the microphone, so I'll say yes, Lisa.
It's a very
great
show.
Story.
I was picking up your glasses,
you were
being so you
very
didn't
good.
Step on them. They were right under your feet where they fell.
So remember, folks, you can like us on the Facebooks. You can tweet us on the tweeters.
Stitch us on the Stitcher.
Yeah, stitch us up. And listen to the podcast, because that way you can hear backstage at Offstage. Like right after this show, we're having a wonderful conversation with John Reedy. We're going to learn all about him. His stories.
The depths of John Reedy.
How can folks get the easiest way to get, other than just getting it from the, it's no longer iTunes, it's now Apple Podcasts.
I still call it.
How else can we get to it?
You just go to offstageonair.com. You enter your email in the little box there on the right, and voila, we appear. But you know what? If you just found us, you can stay right on that site and listen to all past shows, too.
That's right. All right. So we're gonna go. Austin Monitor News is next if you're listening here on the terrestrial radio. Stand back for Backstage at Offstage if you're listening on the podcast. And if you're not, you might want to, so you can hear our conversation with John Reedy. We're going to listen to a little bit from the newly released Ain't Too Proud, the Temptations musical,
yes,
and My Girl, which is one of my favorite
Such
Temptations
a good song.
Songs. And we will see you next week when we look at what's happening off stage and on the air. We will see you next week. Bye.
Ciao.
I've got sunshine on a cloudy day. When it's cold outside, I've got the month of May. I guess you say,
the curtain has come down on The Deluge, the musical, the story of a rainstorm that was supposed to be, but then ended up not being such a bad thing after all. Nobody died. There was no drama. The show closed, and the show was over.
Dun, dun, dun.
So we've left the backstage area. We're outside next to the dumpsters. We've got umbrellas, but it's not really raining. But here we are. And out with us here is John Reedy of Austin Creative Alliance. Hi, John.
Hi. How's it going?
Good. Welcome to Backstage.
Thanks for having me.
Right before we started recording, you mentioned a friend of yours who was an original investor with Hedvig.
Mm-hmm.
That's cool.
Yeah, he was running a club in New Orleans at the time, and I don't know how he met John Cameron Mitchell, but they had a relationship through that club.
From New Orleans?
Yeah, maybe he had done it there.
I was about to say, he workshopped this character in random small clubs everywhere in Syracuse.
RSCs, we call those.
So I'm not surprised.
Yeah, it was a really cool club in the French Quarter that some of the bands I used to manage played. And then at one point, Morgan was like, "Oh, I'm working on this show. I invested in this show." And then the movie came out, and then
next thing you know. But he invested, which is a good thing. My sister, who went to school here at the University of Texas in the early 1970s, one of her friends came to her and says, "Hey, I'm putting some money into this small little organic grocery store here. You want to join me?" And she said, "No."
Oh,
he is now super duper wealthy, and she's not living anymore, but not because of that. Anyway, John Reedy, you're here with us. We want to learn
because of that. Oh, Lisa, you're on fire today.
Yeah. We want to learn more about you specifically. You don't come from theater.
Nope.
You come from the music biz, right?
I do. Yeah.
So, well, first of all, before we get into your career, where did you grow up physically? You're not from here.
No, I grew up.
You're not from around these here parts.
I grew up in the oldest Cajun settlement in Louisiana, a place called Vacherie, Louisiana.
Well, really?
In Louisiana?
Hold on just
that?
A second. Before we get into that, that surprises me.
Yeah?
Yes. I would have thought you would be from Southern or Northern California.
Really?
Or the Northeast somewhere. Yes, I don't see backwoods Louisiana at all.
He's totally Louisiana man to
me.
It is about 40 miles due west of New Orleans. It's a little town on the Mississippi River of about 2,000, 3,000 people where everybody's related. Everybody knows your business. A lot of cool parts of that. The food was amazing.
So are you near are you between New Orleans and Lafayette?
Yeah, not very close to Lafayette at all. But,
okay.
Sort of between south of Baton Rouge and west of New Orleans.
Okay. Cool. Well, awesome.
Yeah.
It's like who knows? 40 miles
so do you still have family
out
there?
You got a lot of
I do, yeah.
And did you, so you come from music.
Mm-hmm.
You, and I know that you manage, you've managed music.
Yeah,
musicians.
Yeah, that
are
was
you
career.
Also a musician?
I am not.
Really?
I know. It's really
so
unusual.
Where did you, how did you get into managing music?
Well, I've always been incredibly passionate about music. My dad, when I was a kid, lived in New Orleans, and we listened to local music. It was, you know, when I was looking at colleges and was thinking about moving, I actually chose Austin because of its music scene, because I couldn't imagine living
in the city.
It's the
live music capital of the world.
Some say. But I really couldn't imagine living in a city without a robust local live music scene, because my family, my aunt used to sell gumbo at the Jazz Fest, and she collected the posters, and my dad, I mean, we listened to local music, you know, when
like,
I was a
kid.
It's
hard not to be in Louisiana and not listen to music, like to grow up in Louisiana.
And it was part of life, so it permeated life. People played, people sang.
That's why I think what makes the music so special that comes out of Louisiana.
Yeah, it was.
So are you a crawdad lover?
I'm mildly allergic.
Okay.
Really?
Yeah.
All right, so then the next question is...
That's got to be hard living in a place where that's all around you.
You know, I have an iodine sensitivity, and it smells like poison to me.
Well, good.
It was hard, because they all... I mean,
it's everywhere.
Yeah.
All the time.
Like, lint was not a big deal.
So you lived in New Orleans, or you lived in Louisiana, and you... and at what point in your life did you start thinking, hey, I want to... do the back end of music, if you will?
Not until after college. I moved to Austin to attend UT.
To study what?
I studied film.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Interesting. So
did
you were
you
always
make any
in the
films?
Creative arts.
I did. But... I made several films. I continue to occasionally make films.
Uh-huh. In what role? As a director?
Director mostly. Uh-huh. I've directed a bunch of concert films for my clients and music videos and things like that. It was fun. You know, I shared an editing bay with Robert Rodriguez, which was cool.
Heard of him.
While he was making El Mariachi, and then when I graduated, I didn't find the film industry appealing. So I ended up working at Amy's Ice Creams, and then I was always seeing music every night, going out and seeing music. I got to be really friendly with a lot of musicians. And a guy named David Garza.
We know David.
David.
So David in like 1994... was like, hey, I'm going to California in a van with my band. Do you want to sell T-shirts? And then like 2 years later, he was signed to Atlantic. I got him on big tours with bands at the time that were really, really big, Better Than Ezra, Blind Melon.
Yeah.
It's sort of...
So you managed David?
Nah, not technically. We worked together. I was his tour manager. Okay.
You know, he did the music for There and Back at Ground Floor Theater.
Oh, no, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
He's so talented. I just kind of got into it. I was a tour manager for a long time. I lived in vans with bands and traveled around the country.
Tour manager is a tough job.
Yeah.
What era of, what years are you talking about?
94 touring? To 98.
Okay.
As you know, you can't do that past 30. I was in my
20s. You can't.
No, you were actually really using a map, not Googling it on your phone.
No, no. I mean,
you had to actually navigate.
Also, I used to know a lot of in my business. I knew a lot of stagehands that did a lot of the rock and roll tours and the bus in the early 80s, and that was really hard living because there's a big drug culture going on.
Yeah.
There.
Big.
So it was a little crazy.
It's a hard life, but it was fun. And even to this day, if you drop me in the middle of Indianapolis, I can find my way around because I got to go to every city in the country two or three times a year.
Yeah, but why would we go to Indianapolis?
Well, if you wanted to
city.
Punish me by dropping me in the middle of Indianapolis.
I know you said it's a hard life, but would you say it's a hard knock life?
Yes.
Okay, good.
I would.
We just have to bring some theater stuff in here every now and then. So that was the bulk of your career before you found ACA, or was there anything that happened between music management and Austin Creative Alliance?
Well, as I got further along in my career, and especially as the music industry changed, it kind of moved away from me. I was really interested in artist development. And finding real artists, which the music business used to be about,
right?
You know, there was, you know, I wanted to be John Hammond, the guy who discovered Bob Dylan and Joni Mitchell, and as the industry changed and moved away from that set of values, I started working with artists who wanted to do cross-disciplinary stuff. I started working with Graham Reynolds, and through that we did worked with Bally Austin and, you know, the Long Center. And then I worked with a band called Mother Falcon who did a lot of film scoring, and they did a stage play. And so I got really interested in that cross-disciplinary stuff. It was fun for me. It was new to me. And suddenly in the last, you know, 5 or 6 years of my owning my management company, I was producing off-Broadway. I was working with the Lincoln Center and the Kennedy Center and the Long Center and Ballet Austin. And that was more interesting at that phase of my life and career than just putting out a record and going on tour and putting out a record and going on tour.
So now that you've found yourself in the nonprofit world, do you see that as where it's going to end for you? You're going to stick with this? Or do you see John
another
Reedy?
Another novel.
Yeah, is there another chapter that goes off in yet a different direction?
You know, it's just, to me, it's just a continuation. Not an artist myself. I'm a business person, but I always loved...
You know the biz of art.
Yeah, and so I loved empowering artists. I loved helping artists make work and getting them to the place that they could be artists and not worry about all that other stuff.
But that is an art in itself.
I hope so. Mm-hmm. And that's what... I see that as just a continuum. ACA does that, but in a much broader way. I don't know how long I might stay in the nonprofit sector, but I do think, especially even in the music business, local grassroots music venues around the country are increasingly turning to a nonprofit business model because you basically don't make any money running a music venue anyway. So why not qualify for the tax breaks? And, you know,
touche.
So yeah, I mean, there's quite a few. Joe's Pub in New York and the Old Town School of Folk Music in Chicago. Most major cities have a nonprofit music venue now.
Well, I guess the issue would be there because, you know, nobody owns a nonprofit. Mm-hmm. So that I learned the hard way when I started my first theater and I was setting it up and I wanted to give my – I was putting all the money behind it and I wanted to give my partner – I wanted to give him ownership. And the lawyer, and I said, I want to give my partner 10% stake in the company. And the lawyer looked at me and said,
there's no
stake.
You don't – and I said, what? You mean I can get fired from my own
– Yeah.
And he said, yes, you can. So so it's a different mindset when you beyond the tax deductible
and there's different ways to set it up where you can maintain the ownership of the intellectual property, blah, 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 right. Protect yourself from – but yeah, I think the way the music business has evolved, true artistry is increasingly marginalized.
Right.
And I see a lot of those artists who don't fit in the genre or niche, which is what you have to be now. Interesting artists don't really, you know, don't apply. Just don't do it. Find your own audience, go underground, and increasingly toward the nonprofit.
So in this role and in your life as it is now, because your employment is wide ranging in terms of disciplines of art.
Mm-hmm.
Do you go to more visual artists, theater, other things that you didn't go to before, or were you always patronizing theater and art and music, or along with music?
No, I always have, but it's a lot more intentional now. Mm-hmm. But you know, I saw my first theater in Austin at the Vortex in probably '95.
Yep.
Full frontal nudity, as always.
That's the Vortex.
At the Vortex.
And there's been some family-friendly ones these days that we've been like, what?
Yeah, I know,
no
right?
No nudity? What's going on?
But no, I always have loved theater and loved visual art and loved film and loved dance. But in this position, this job, it's much more intentional. I try to be present in the community. And I'll pick shows often less for something that appeals to me and more of like, I should get to know that company.
How do you feel about show tunes?
Yeah,
you can tell the truth.
It varies widely, let's say that.
Yeah, there's good musicals and bad musicals.
There's you were talking about Hadestown earlier. I actually, for that to get on my radar as a person who doesn't love musical theater, it got on my radar because people within my world of the music business were like, these are great songs.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if it hits that sweet spot, which I think Anais Mitchell does in those songs, mm-hmm. I love it.
Great. Well, John Reedy, thank you for coming and
joining
us.
Thanks for having
backstage.
Me so much.
Thank
I really
you.
Appreciate
yeah,
it. It was fun.
Watch your step going back up into the theater. There is some treacherous steps.
Okay, good to know.
All right.
Bye.
See ya. Bye.
Now that the chips are down, what you gonna do when the chips are down? Now that the chips are down.